From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Our neighbor to the south suffered an unspeakable tragedy over the weekend. The massacre at Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, is now on record as the deadliest mass shooting in American history. The pain is felt here in Georgia and across the nation today as we learn more details about the alleged shooter and his possible motives. We begin today's show with your words of comfort for Orlando. Here's how Georgia grieves for the loss of more than 50 lives taken by an act of violence. This statement is found on the official Facebook page of the Atlanta Pride Committee. It says, quote, "Atlanta Pride stands with our LGBTQ and allied Muslim friends, so many of whom grieve not only this tragedy in Orlando, but also how it is being used to fuel Islamophobia. We choose radical love and hope over fear always." Megan Timmons of Atlanta says, "Tragedies like this are too easily forgotten and lumped together with the ones before them. I want to say this cannot keep happening, but I'm so afraid it will." Becca Ingram from Athens, Georgia says, "My heart is heavy with the news out of Orlando. I cannot find the words to express what I feel. As a social advocate in training, this is my fight. It has to end. Hashtag pray for Orlando." Civil rights leader and Representative John Lewis tweets this, "There is no possible way to justify the murder of anyone because of his or her way of life. We must create a world at peace with itself." And Clinton Edminster of Savannah was inspired to write about what happened at Pulse nightclub. He put the killings in the context of the racially motivated murder of Emmett Till in 1955.
His mother said, "There was no way I could describe what was in that box. No way. And I just wanted the world to see." So she decided to have an open casket funeral in Chicago, and thousands and thousands of people came and saw what his body actually looked like at that point. So the connection that I'm trying to make is that when we see things like that, it makes them real for us. And so often it's the concept of 50 people being killed in a nightclub is unreal. Can't even imagine it. But it is real, and it's really ugly. And maybe we should see that. Maybe we should see what it looks like when something like this happens, so that we all work so hard to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
That's Clinton Edminster of Savannah. We always love to get your thoughts. You can call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio and join the discussion. We might feature your comments on the show. Okay. The Pulse nightclub massacre is the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. Every time tragedies like this occur, the nation again debates gun control. And our opinions on the issue are often fueled by emotions. But what does science tell us? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta study a host of public health issues. Gun violence is one of them, but it's limited in its research in this area. Should shootings be viewed as a public health issue? I first asked this question on the show in January. Garen Wintemute was my guest. He oversees the Violence Prevention Research Program at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Mark Rosenberg also joined us. He's the head of the Task Force for Global Health based in DeKalb County. The conversation started with a question to Mark about how much we really know about gun violence already.
From public health, we want to know four things about the problem about gun violence. First, what's the problem? Who, what, where, when, how does it happen? How many people are shot? What's the relationship between the shooter and the victim? What kind of weapon? Where does it come from? But we want to answer first the questions any good reporter would ask. The second thing we want to know is, what are the causes? What are the risk factors? What increases the chance that someone will be shot? What protects people? What decreases it? But the second is, what are the causes? Third, what works to prevent it? And this is getting more complicated now because it's harder to figure out what works and what the impact of a certain type of measure or intervention will be. And then the last question we ask is, how do you do it? How do you implement something that works on a small scale? How do you make it a larger scale program? But we want to ask those four different questions to a problem like gun violence. And in this country, we know something about the problem, the who, what, where, when, and how. We know a little bit about the causes, but we know almost nothing about what works to prevent it. because we were stopped in our efforts to find the answers.
And you were actually part of that, which we're going to go back to that story in a moment. But I wanted to ask you, Garen, you know, when you look up the number of people both injured by gunshot and killed, those numbers differ according to what source you're looking at. Why?
Well, the number killed, there's pretty good agreement on. I think there are different definitions in play of what constitutes violence. One of the misunderstandings of firearm violence is that it's primarily a crime problem. But two-thirds of the deaths from firearm violence are self-inflicted. They're suicides. I'm an ER doc, and I know from experience that the wound doesn't depend on whose finger's on the trigger. Suicide is a form of violence. So if you count both homicide and suicide, there are upwards of 30,000 deaths a year from firearm violence. And to go back to your initial statement, if violence isn't a public health problem, then why are all these people dying from it?
And I wanted to return to what you mentioned earlier, this fight over whether or not the CDC in particular should study it. Now, we're going back, I guess, 20 years at this point, when a Republican-led Congress stripped $2.5 million from the CDC. Mm-hmm. And let me read what they said. In the words of this, what became known as the J. Dickey Amendment, they said no funds for the CDC Injury Center, quote, may be used to advocate or promote gun control. Why did that, in effect, sort of shut down research at the CDC?
Well, I think for a few reasons. The first was, and we need to understand this, there was no ban on doing research. It was a restriction on advocating for gun control. And CDC was not advocating for gun control. CDC was doing research, very important, legitimate scientific research. But that language was a shot across the bow. And it warned researchers and it warned politicians and bureaucrats that if you try to study this problem of gun violence, we will harass you. We will have senators write to the secretary of HHS and question you. We will make sure that we can use all your time answering our inquiries, but we're going to harass you if you work in this field. The second thing that they did was they stripped the money so that CDC did not have the money to put out requests for proposals. So researchers in the field have to find an area where they can support the research if they're going to commit their time. So it said, we're going to harass you. It took away their money. And then finally, CDC fired the director of the Injury Center, who had been very interested in promoting the science of gun violence prevention.
I want to play a clip. This is from 1996, and this is NRA spokesman Lars Daleside. And he spoke with NPR, and he said at the time their lobbying for this J. Dickey Amendment was specifically because they didn't want the CDC advocating for a ban on guns.
The NRA is not and never has been opposed to research that promotes the safe and responsible use of firearms and work to reduce gun-related deaths.
Garen, I wonder if you think there has been sort of a cooling on research in terms of guns, because as I looked, there doesn't even see private donors willing to step up to the plate and fund this kind of research.
There's absolutely been a chill. We had a research program in the 90s that lost its funding when CDC was no longer able to make grants. We have pieced things together, but yes, there are a small number of private foundations that have been willing to provide funding. The National Institute of Justice has had a small research program just in the last couple of years. The National Institutes of Health have begun funding research. But the larger picture is, if I can, this. We are not a country that turns its back on research and innovation. We are a smart country. We like having the answers to tough questions so that we can use those answers to solve tough problems. We've proven that with motor vehicle trauma. We've proven it with cancer and heart disease and the diseases that come from smoking. And here's this one exception. When it comes to firearm violence, we have simply turned our back on what America does best. The open question is how many people have died as a result.
I want to play another one for you, Mark, and this is, we haven't mentioned so far that the number of people who are killed by gun violence every year in the U.S. is somewhere north of 30,000 people. Here we hear Sandro Galea, the dean of Boston University's School of Public Health, and Boston, at least, says that as many as 190,000 people are injured. And one of the reasons Sandra says we should treat this like a public health issue is because you have to consider the other people affected by gun violence rather than just the victim.
Then you have the family members of the those who died, and probably 10 to 20% of them will also go on to have long-term emotional sequelae. So very, very quickly, you have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who are affected by this epidemic. And there is no other way of characterizing this than it is an epidemic and it is a preventable epidemic.
Help me understand what he's talking about there. Now, we had a report from the Bureau of Justice Statistics that spoke to this as well, the sort of ripple effect of gun violence. How's that different from other violence?
We're just starting to understand the consequences of violence in this country. We used to think that it meant you had to repair the wound or a broken arm or a broken leg. But what we found out now is that violence experienced by children leads to long-term impacts, which this country can't even afford to take care of. It leads to hypertension, to asthma, to drug use, to violence, to suicide. Massive, massive impacts on the future health of people. So that fixing the wound, fixing the injury is the tiniest, tiniest part of the problem. I want to say something else, and I want to say something about Garen Wintemute. Garen is an extraordinary and brilliant researcher who has been so committed to this field, even when research funding dried up. CDC has an extraordinary bunch of people ready to do scientific research on this. They have the largest collection of scientists in the world dedicated to violence prevention. But we're not letting people like Garen or CDC do the research that can save us. And it's because of what the NRA did. And what was said before is not quite right. The NRA framed it as either or. Either you do research and take all our guns away, or you don't do any research and you let us keep our guns. They framed it as a stark black and white. If you so much as talk about research about guns, then we will shut you down. And it's not either or. We can do the research, we can find out what works, and we can prevent abuse of gun rights. We can protect the gun rights of people if we do the research right.
That's the voice of Mark Rosenberg. He's the head of the Task Force for Global Health. We also heard from Garen Wintemute. He's the director of the Violence Prevention Research Program at the UC Davis School of Medicine. I spoke with them both back in January. So what do you think? Should gun violence be studied as a public health issue? Would that help us understand and prevent more killings? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk to share your thoughts. And we also would love to get your thoughts on the Pulse nightclub murders. If you'd like to share a message with the community of Orlando, we welcome your voice and your words. That number again is 404-500-9457. This is On Second Thought. The original Scared Straight documentary aired on PBS in the late 1970s. It featured some undisciplined children whose parents were at the end of their rope. The kids were handed over to jailers and prison guards for tours of correctional facilities. It was an extreme attempt to motivate good behavior from the kids, and it was the first public display of what is now a common feature of juvenile justice efforts. But is it even possible to use fear to get an at-risk kid back on track? GPB's Grant Blankenship explores that question for Macon.
It's a Friday morning on the cell block at the Bibb County Law Enforcement Center in Macon. About 20 children, boys and girls, are being forced to do calisthenics by inmates in orange jumpsuits. Here, this is called the Consider the Consequences program, and it's just over a year old. Just minutes earlier, parents and guardians explained why they brought their children here.
He stated that he bought some brass knuckles.
Yeah, he got some brass knuckles from another child, but he got caught with them.
Ellis Sinclair is a lieutenant in the Bibb County Sheriff's Office, and he runs this program. These are the behaviors he wants to change.
And when I say change the behavior, we're not really into the scaring business. A child wants to be loved, and a child wants to know that somebody cares.
So programs like this pose a question. How well does exposing a child to a day of stress at your local jail keep them out of jail as an adult?
The fear arousal approach does not work.
That's Paul Klonoski. He's a criminologist at Clarion University in Pennsylvania. As a doctoral student, he couldn't shake the memory of that Scared Straight documentary and what it promised.
You know, this idea touting a, you know, reduction rate of recidivism by 80% always stuck in the back of my mind.
So Klonoski and his research partners Keith Bell and Kimberly Dodson decided to see if the science around these programs over the last 30-plus years bore that number out. What they found was that a child was actually more likely to go to jail as an adult if they'd been through a Scared Straight program. How much more likely?
We're seeing an increase anywhere between 15 to 28%.
That reflects the range of conclusions across a dozen different studies. Nowhere did they find evidence that scaring children in jails ever had a positive effect. At best, it did nothing. Their findings were published in the Journal of Offender Rehabilitation in 2010. Back in the county jail, children are in the actual cell blocks. Cell doors are open. One 9-year-old boy is lifted by a pair of jail guards and shoved Superman style into an open cell. A camera crew from a syndicated TV show captures everything. Paul Klonoski doesn't see how this helps.
You know, the confrontation does not work, especially because many of these children are already survivors.
So what would help? Well, remember Lieutenant Sinclair's focus on love?
A child wants to be loved.
Klonoski says the programs that work usually involve calm and often frank talk with inmates.
The inmates being able to have a conversation with them and say, hey, listen, you do not want to end up here like me, and let me tell you why.
There is some of that here. But Bibb County Sheriff David Davis says scaring kids is the cornerstone of his program.
I think it is. I think it serves a purpose.
He's seen the TV story and still stands by what happens here.
But it's just one little piece of the bigger puzzle.
What comes after is a year of life skills classes for children and parents alike. Paul Klonoski says that part sounds good. But he and other criminologists would love to take a closer look.
The idea of being able as a criminologist to evaluate this rigorously, there may be some positives here.
Sheriff Davis says he already has experts steering his program, but he'd take more help. Consider the Consequences takes in a new class of young people in just a few weeks. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon.
Grant has some fantastic photos to go along with that story. You'll find them at gpbnews.org. There are many ways to describe reactions to the deaths of Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, and other victims of police violence. But one four-letter word has surfaced time and again: rage. Specifically, black rage from African Americans fed up with violence targeted at unarmed members of their community. But Emory professor Carol Anderson says this focus on black rage misses the point.
Amadou Diallo was mowed down in a hell of NYPD bullets on February 4, 1999. 41 bullets were fired into the West African immigrant, 19 of which hit their target. But what left me truly stunned was the clinical, antiseptic policy rationale espoused by New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. The mayor glibly and confidently spouted one statistic after the next on the news show Nightline to demonstrate how the NYPD was the, quote, most restrained and best behaved police department you could imagine. But restrained and behaved police don't fire 41 bullets at an unarmed man. He touted policies that had reduced crime in New York and dismissed African Americans' concerns about racial profiling, stop and frisk, and police brutality as unfounded. Instead, he countered that the real issue was the, quote, community's racism against the police and unwillingness to take responsibility for the issues plaguing their neighborhoods. I didn't know what to call it at the time. What to name the unsettling and disturbing performance by Giuliani that I had just witnessed. 15 years later, I experienced that same feeling, although the circumstances this time were somewhat different. In August 2014, Ferguson, Missouri went up in flames, and media commentators served up variations of the same story. African Americans, angered by the police killing of an unarmed black teen, were taking out their frustration in unproductive and predictable ways, rampaging, burning, and looting. Framing the discussion, dominating it, in fact, was an overwhelming focus on black rage. With so much attention focused on the flames, everyone had ignored the logs, the kindling. That led to an epiphany. What was really at work here was white rage. White rage is not about visible violence, but rather it works its way through the courts, the legislatures, and a range of government bureaucracies. It wreaks havoc subtly, almost imperceptibly, too imperceptibly, certainly for a nation consistently drawn to the spectacular, to what it can see. White rage doesn't have to wear sheets, burn crosses, or take to the streets. Working the halls of power, it can achieve its ends far more effectively, far more destructively. The trigger for white rage is black advancement. It is not the mere presence of black people that is the problem. Rather, it is blackness with ambition, with drive, with purpose, with aspirations, and with demands for full and equal citizenship. It is blackness that refuses to accept subjugation, to give up. A formidable array of policy assaults and legal contortions has consistently punished black resilience, black resolve. The truth is, white rage has undermined democracy, warped the Constitution, weakened the nation's ability to compete economically, squandered billions of dollars on baseless incarceration, rendered an entire region sick, poor, and woefully undereducated, and left cities nothing less than decimated. All this havoc has been wreaked simply because African Americans wanted to work, get an education, live in decent communities, raise their families, and vote. Because they were unwilling to take no for an answer.
That was an excerpt from Carol Anderson's new book, White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She's a professor of African American Studies at Emory University. Last month, a treasure trove of data was released from the Panama Papers Project. Many large companies were implicated, including several notable names from the Peach State. Those documents revealed that businesses established shell corporations are known as limited liability companies, and they did that allegedly in order to hide money from government agencies. But not all of these dummy corporations are located overseas. Atlanta Journal Constitution reporter Willoughby Mariano did her best to track down one elusive LLC here in Georgia. She joins us now to share what she found. It's good to have you back, Willoughby.
It's great to be here.
Now, LLCs are not always shady.
Absolutely.
What is an LLC?
Well, it's short for Limited Liability Company. And basically, it was created, the entity or this type of business entity was created, in the 80s or so. So that way, small businesses could have an opportunity to get the tax advantages that only sort of wealthy large corporations can get. And the limited liability refers to the fact that you're not personally liable for the debt if you're your debts if the business goes bust. You can you could still have a life. You don't have to go bankrupt. Your children don't have to starve if you
don't lose your home.
Yeah,
they don't take your car.
Don't. Yeah,
yeah. But why does an LLC a good place for a company to say to hide money?
Well, this is the peculiar thing. It didn't start out like that. What happened is that over the years, a variety of business interests have tried to change the law so that way there are fewer transparency requirements than there would be for, let's say, a traditional corporation. So over the years, for instance, you were not required to disclose the responsible parties. You don't have to disclose a CEO, a secretary, any of your corporate officers. You don't have to disclose the name of anyone, really, who's a responsible party at all.
Okay, so you tried to track down one particular LLC. Which one was it?
Well, it's called Illimite or Illimite. No one can
pronounce it because you can't find who's behind it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
What brought you to Illimite?
Yes, Illimite. Let's decide on
let's
that
go
one.
Let's go on that one.
Yeah, well, How I found out about this is that we wanted to cover sort of our domestic corporate secrecy issue here, and that's, you know, LLCs. And so I went to code enforcement because I know they have a lot of problems with this type of company. And I asked them, well, hey, what are your worst? This was one of three. So I visited the house, and it was a wreck, and it was basically harming the neighborhood. There were kids around it. It was a block from a school. And I decided, well, hey, I'll try to find it, you know.
Who owns it?
Yeah. I'll try to find who owns it and see what they have to say about their
company. But it was harder than you thought to find the owner of this home.
Yeah, I'm usually pretty good at finding people. But this one was extraordinarily difficult because they seemed to do even less than what typical LLCs did. They did do less than what typical LLCs did.
Yeah, the home
LLCs
was owned
did.
By an LLC.
Yes, yeah, the home was owned by an LLC, and they registered in 2012 with the state. They bought 10 properties within 10 days of being founded or so. Well, you know, they bought a handful of properties after 10 days of being founded, and then they were basically never heard from again. This is it. They own just a handful of really rough properties.
And they don't, because as you mentioned, they don't have to disclose who's on their board, who runs it. How did you find out who's behind it?
Well, ultimately, I really didn't. I was able to sort of track down through business records, through federal bankruptcy records, through a variety of public record sources who previously owned the property and who transferred it for free to Illamite. But that owner, who lives in $500,000 house, again owned by another LLC, did not take responsibility for it. He made all sorts of sort of contradictory statements about who owned it. He said he didn't know who he sold it to. And then he also said that he sold it to a friend. So so I couldn't get to the bottom of it.
And we don't have the sale papers, the real estate papers, to know.
Well, we have a portion. We do actually have online. You can go to a state website and find out, you know, a bit about the transaction. But the people who signed for it, well, no one signed for it really. The only person who signed for it was the person selling the properties.
It just went to Illamite.
Yes,
and we don't know who Illamite is.
No, we don't. No one signed for it at all. It was notarized. There was the name of a lawyer on it, and that was it.
What would be the purpose for this LLC to just own a bunch of properties and do nothing with them?
In this neighborhood, where this particular property is located, in the West Atlanta neighborhood of Ashview Heights, people just buy properties and they sit on them. They are purely speculators. They are waiting for a time when more and more wealthier people, people with more resources, move in, see the beauty of these properties, these historic homes, and fix them up. And then they'll sell. But for the time being, these properties are just hurting the neighborhoods.
But because they're sitting vacant in a vacant home, as we've talked about many times on this show, is almost always a detriment to a neighborhood.
Yes. And in this one was particularly detrimental. Its door was wide open for weeks. And I actually managed to surprise a prostitute and her customer at the location while knocking on the door.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, well, I couldn't even knock on the door, actually, because the door was wide open, so I knocked on the door frame. And then you could see some kind of nasty stuff inside. Obviously, you had your classic...
Don't need to get those details.
Yeah, no, but just empty vodka bottles and other stuff.
So... At this point, is there no way, I mean, does the LLC completely protect whomever are the owners of these properties? Because oftentimes, especially as a house or a property begins to go derelict, the city can step in. Is that impossible because it's a limited liability corporation?
Well, it is possible. This particular house at 1045 Ashby Grove is actually in what's called the in rem process. So they're trying to use legal means to, acquire the or to, I guess, condemn the property, clean and close it, and then put a lien on it and then have it sold on the auction block and put back into productive use. But that means that we, as taxpayers here in Atlanta, have to pay for that.
Yeah, that's an expensive process.
It is. Thousands of dollars. And imagine that happening 800 times or so for the current properties that are right now in the same sort of situation. And then the many more that haven't even gotten through this process yet.
That's a lot of money. That is Willoughby Mariano. She's a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Willoughby, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
This is On Second Thought. Sixteen is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize. The honor has been awarded to dozens of people from or living in Georgia. And so we'll spend some time with past winners all year long. It's a new series we're calling Pulitzer Peaches. Today we revisit my conversation with author Alice Walker. Her rural upbringing in Eatonton has had a heavy influence on her writing. She became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1983 for her novel The Color Purple. I spoke with her back in October when she was in Georgia. Here's an excerpt from that conversation. It is a real honor to welcome you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
I think that many people who love your work, and I have to imagine that's the way, as an artist and a writer, that's the way most people, general people, know you, although you're incredibly active and have always been in activism. I think people sometimes forget your history as part of the civil rights movement, which goes back to your days as a student at Spelman. Can you explain to me what that path was like? And what I mean by that is, at the same time that you're learning how to become a novelist and a writer, you're also focusing a great deal of attention on activism. You're taking time off to lead voter registration drives. Were those two separate paths, the art and the activism?
Well, no, you have to understand that if you're going to be an artist, you need to, for instance, be able to make a living. And if you can't make a living except doing, you know, chores that were specifically designed for just black people, then that is not, you know, that's not a good thing. So you have to go against the culture that is actually forcing you to do things that are likely to make it impossible for you to be an artist. So, for instance, one of the things that still prevailed when I was growing up was that I couldn't try on a dress in a store, you know, on the main street. And that could really upset your whole life, not to mention the day, you know, that your mother brought you into the store.
So let me take you back then, since you mentioned growing up. I read one place where you said you had to hide your writing from your family. You started writing when you were about 8 years old?
Sometime early, yeah.
Why did you keep that secret?
Well, when you grow up in a family of, you know, lots of people.
Yeah, you were the youngest of eight, right?
Seven brothers and sisters. And a very, very, very small house and very little paper. It was better to keep things from my two brothers, who were very likely to, you know, want to intrude and read and laugh and whatever. So I learned to write in my head much more than on paper for many, many, many years. And in fact, I almost never did drafts until quite late in my writing life. I preferred to compose things almost entirely in my head and then write once. And, you know, that would probably be it. But it would take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Do you think that has, in the end, affected your writing style?
I don't know. I mean, I would imagine everything you do affects you know, what you produce. Yeah. But it helped me because it saved a lot of trees. And I was glad of that because I always loved trees. And I just liked the reality that people, human beings, are so beautifully made that we can hold an awful lot in the mind and work on things in the mind. And, you know, and there's a freedom to that, so that often you can just avoid a lot of things that are going on around you because you have a world that is full in your own imagination.
I wanted to ask you about Zora Neale Hurston, who seems to have been a constant influence for you. And I mean, going, people said that you almost single-handedly rescued her from obscurity. You went and actually found her gravesite back in the 70s. You've had a link with her most of your life. What draws you to her?
Because I didn't have a link. She died when I was a junior in high school, and I had no clue that she'd even existed. When I went away to college at Sarah Lawrence in New York, my teacher had known her, but never mentioned her. And her name was in the first book I was published in, but because, you know, at that time we thought only the men were writers, I never even noticed. And so years later, when I discovered that she had existed, that she'd written Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I adored it, I couldn't believe how she had been so, forgotten by people who had known her and so ignored. And then to discover that she'd also been vilified and you know, very badly treated. So, yes, I loved her so much, and I went to Florida, and I found the only sunken place in this huge field that could have been her grave, and that was, you know, a wonderful thing for me. I felt, that was something that she really deserved, and now people, you know, people love her, and they go there by the thousands every year.
You know, I wonder, Zora Neale Hurston could have been a cautionary tale if you had seen her that way, in terms of being careful about the way that your activism and your political voice may influence the way people see you and treat you. And I wonder if you ever thought about that. You've been so active all your life, and you have never shied away from putting that into your novels and your poems and all of the other writing that you do. Did it ever concern you that it might affect the way that you were treated, or whether you were published, or the way you were reviewed?
Oh, well, yes, and it has of course affected, you know, everything my whole life. But what you learn is that it is such a joy to be able to speak what you see and to share what you know, that is worth the consequences. So I've always felt that. And I think she did too. I mean, in her case, it was to show the beauty of African-American Southern culture. And she was going to do that whether people liked it or didn't like it or whatever they had to say about her. She paid the price, and I think you just have to be willing to accept that whatever other people do is their business. You know, your business is what the mission that you're on, and it's not something that's negotiable, really. I mean, it's just who you are and what you are put here to do.
So, in your book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, since we're talking about joy here, this is a book that's it's difficult to read, and I don't mean the writing itself is difficult. It's that you are talking about the issue, the practice of female genital mutilation in parts of Africa and the Middle East and other places, and you do not shy away at all from graphic depictions. It's a beautiful book, but it's hard for me to imagine how you came at the beauty and the language with such a topic. And I wonder if you said you don't write drafts, but do you go back and on a book like that to make sure of where that line is?
Oh, yeah. No. By then, I was doing drafts. I was just explaining that in the beginning, you know, I didn't do many drafts because I had learned to be very careful of of people intruding, and also we didn't have a lot of money to spend on paper. But no, of course, as I went along, I could afford paper, and I could afford drafts, and I could throw things in the waste paper basket. But yeah, with that particular book, it's just that I love little girls. You know, I love children, and I couldn't imagine. I learned about this when I was in Kenya, when I was, in my 20s, I guess. And it was so shocking that I just hid it from myself for decades. I couldn't imagine what I could do or if anybody could do this. Because we're talking about millions of children, and so I worried it and worried it for a long time. And then I realized that it was obviously something that I had been trained to do, to write about this. My background was so poor and so hard, and yet somehow my parents and my community had sent me off, and I had become educated, and I could write, and then the universe had said, well, here, look at this. And so it was clear to me that I was there. I had the tools, and I should do this work. And I did it, and I'm very glad. I know a lot of people have been very unhappy. And, I've heard from a couple of the surgeons who do this in hospitals in the West, for instance, in London and New York and, other places, which, is shocking enough.
Yeah.
But they, they had thought that instead of doing it in an unhygiene way, we should do it, hygienically in our hospital, as if that helps the child later on who has to grow into an adult who has to deal with the consequences of being mutilated in this way.
A lot of scholars say that novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, is part of a trilogy with The Temple of My Familiar and The Color Purple. And I wonder if that's how you intend... I mean, scholars are writing about them that way, but I wonder if that's how you intended them.
No, I don't believe in sequels, and I don't believe in trilogies for myself. Other people could have them. But no, I mean, the characters sometimes are, Tashi is in... On one page.
Tashi's the African wife of Seeley's son from the novel Possessing the Secret of
Right.
Joy.
Yeah. But this is her story, and it's not really... but on the other hand, if people want to read it that way, I really don't mind. I mean, read it however you'd like. But I don't... I remember when we made the movie of The Color Purple, and they were wondering and wanting a sequel... and I said, absolutely not. I mean, I don't want any spinoffs. I don't want, to wake up one day and have, some crazy, idiotic sentences coming out of anybody else's mouth. Seeley's or Shug's or Sophia's or Mister's. It would be horrendous. Because each work comes as a whole, complete thing itself. And you don't have any plots and plans, I mean, at least I don't, for trying to spin it off into something else. I have to be really drawn to each individual subject and each situation, and then I give it my full attention for a couple of years.
Now, you've described yourself as a womanist as opposed to a feminist. What does that mean? What's the difference?
Well, I'm an African-American. My adventure, and actually it has been an adventure, but... reality here in the United States is very different from that of a white person or a white woman. So, there is feminism, which is a valid thing, and I am fine to be a feminist, but womanism means that I incorporate and that I stand firmly in my tradition as an African-American woman and what that has meant.
Is that a response? There has been a lot of complaints from women of color that the feminist movement, the new feminist movement, is a largely white female movement and is sometimes insensitive and sometimes openly aggressive to the struggles of women of color. Is that part of what you're responding to?
Well, I think the truth is really that. What we're seeing is something that has been going on all the time, is that, generally speaking, I think many white feminists have seen the struggle to be equal with the white man, and that is to basically, you know, be a bit above everybody else as a couple. And this is the history, you know. I mean, that is just the reality. And I think many women of color and other, you know, women in the world have assumed that feminism meant that your loyalty would be to all the women of the planet. It wouldn't be to, you know, marry the top guy and then rule over everybody else. But what seems to be, you know, somewhat unsettling is the notion that the white woman who comes to consciousness about her own, you know, inequality because she's female is actually wanting just to be equal with the man who's on top, i.e. the white man, and therefore not loyal to the other women of the planet, and in fact often is detrimental to them. For instance, in the government, where often white women who come to power don't seem to be all that conscious that the countries that they, you know, talk about bombing are full of women. You know, they are full of women and children. So what kind of feminism is that? You know, I mean, to be consciously aware of women and children would mean that you would not say, as Hillary did at some point, we will obliterate Iran. You can't talk about obliterating, you know, a country and all the people and still say you are a feminist. I mean, what are you talking about?
Alice Walker, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker. I spoke with her back in October. And that's our show for today. But this week and for weeks to come, the nation will be focused on the shootings in Orlando. It was the most deadly mass shooting in our nation's history. So what are your thoughts? What message do you send to Orlando? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPP News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.